I'll start with a brief outline of what I'm going to speak. So it will be the Kastler framework, which just means that I will not start necessarily with the observable algebra, but with the bigger field algebra. In this case, it will be my Clifford algebra, complex Clifford algebra. And then I will introduce superselection of the weak hypercharge. And after a brief survey of previous attempts to understand the origin of the standard model, I will introduce the Clifford algebra as the graded Z to graded tensor product of Clifford 4 and Clifford 6. In fact, I will use this tensor product, which has been previously introduced by Kolb in 2018. And then we'll see that the assumption of the superselection of weak hypercharge make sterile neutrino special. We cannot separate particles from antiparticles for it because they have same zero value of the weak hypercharge. I will skip, I think, this point now, because otherwise I will not speak about the simple components of the observable Jordan subalgebra and about the role of combining in the Jordan subalgebra observables with symmetry generators, because that won't fit with a 1 hour talk. But the important point will be that the Higgs field fits nicely in the Clifford algebra framework as the odd part of a superconnection. I mean, it's a notion introduced, I will say a few words when we come to this superconnection. And we'll see the role of the Bianchian identity for the supercurvature, which allows to extend beyond the standard procedure the notion of supercurvature and to account for symmetry breaking. Then I'll make the deduced from a bosonic Lagrangian using the square of the supercurvature, as usual. Mass relations among the gauge bosons, which would recover relations known to from ground unified theories, but there will be one new relation for the Higgs mass, which happens to be satisfied with less than a percentage error. And I'll conclude with some summary and discussion of open problems. Now, the Clifford algebra approach to the standard model is not new. I learned from the thesis of Paul already that there was work of Castleboni and Gatto some 40 years ago, more than 40 years ago. And here we'll say some, we have to give some more argument to see the role of specific Clifford algebras. And we'll use this famous classification, and that will lead us, will in fact first start with desiderata, which comes from what we do know from the standard model, or if you like, from observations. And but first, a few more words about the framework. What the fact is that since we'll put a special emphasis on superselection rules, and this, albeit it's an old notion introduced by Wigner and Weidmann 70 years ago, it's not perhaps very popular, so I will remind it that superselection rules are given by observables which commute with all observables and define coherent superposition, define coherent sectors by the eigenvalues of the superselected observables. And we cannot define a pure state, a coherent superposition, from vectors which have different eigenvalues of different charges, say. On the contrary, when particles and antiparticles of some kind have the same value of the superselected charges, then we can have Majorana particles, which are in fact coherent superposition from particles and antiparticles. So, well, Clifford algebras, if you like, are suggested by the fact that fundamental fermions seem to come in numbers 4 or 16, or its powers of 2, and these are precisely the dimensions of spinor representations and the Clifford algebras themselves. There is another property which we'll single out. We like to have real Clifford algebras, that is, Majorana spinors, and at the same time would like to have complex chiral representations. So our algebra will be the complexification of a real algebra, or if you prefer, we start with a complex algebra which has a real structure. And real structures have been used and classified, for instance, in the non-commutative geometry approach to the standard model. Alain Cohn had made an emphasis on the choice of real structure. And it turns out that for the overall algebra, we have the structure, the real structures of Clifford algebras are classified again modulo 8, like the real Clifford algebras, and will take the characteristic signature of n equal 2, which is the same as Clifford 10. And it is good to remember that first Clifford, to see before giving abstract, instead of giving abstract justification, just to consider the important examples. We have Clifford 3-1 and as the Lorentz algebra, which has signature 2, and it is characterized by having Majorana spinors and natural complexification by introducing gamma 5, which is I times the Clifford 3-1 pseudoscalar, the Coxeter element, which gives the simplification, and we have complex chiral spinors coming naturally. If you take the case n equal 2, this gives, if you like, two-dimensional conformal field theory, and on the other hand, it's in pure mathematics, the Dirac equation comes as a Cauchy-Riemann equation. So, indeed, when we consider the internal space, we need an automorphism group which is compact, since in physics the internal symmetry, the gauge groups are compact groups. And then we'll have to consider a matrix of the definite matrix, that is Clifford algebra of the type P0 or 0Q. And among these, we already saw the example of n equal 2. And one could say that the next example, when n equals 0, so the index, the order of the Clifford algebra is Clifford 2 plus 8 times n. And when we take n equals 0, we get two-dimensional theory. When we get set n equal 1, we are coming to the algebra Clifford 10, which is the basis of what I will be talking about. But it's amusing to say, to notice that actually n equal minus 1 also can be considered, and this corresponds to Clifford minus 6, which we heard already in the talk of Maya and Call, that in the talk of Call first, that it was an algebra which generates the octonion.
Ivan, it seems like you may have gotten ahead of yourself in your slides. Maybe you mean to be two slides back.
No, it was on purpose. I wanted to go to
Okay.
faster to the topics. Okay, so we are starting therefore with the algebra P4-10, and its gauge group, its automorphism group is the group spin 10, right, so then. And what we used to define the gauge group of the standard model, we needed an additional structure, and this structure comes from the fact that the Clifford algebra can be described as acting on octonions, or rather the automorphism algebra, the automorphism group spin 10, as a nice representation on O2, on the octonions, and it was noticed by Michel Dubois-Violette back in his first paper that, in fact, it was noticed even before by Gursi, that selecting one imaginary unit and the splitting of the octonions in C plus C3, C cube, one obtains a subgroup of the automorphism group G2 of the octonions, which is precisely the SU3 and can be identified with the color SU3. Moreover, the fact that SU3 is unimodular, that we have SU3 and not U3 as a group of quark color, tells us that the determinant or the vector product triple should play a role, and the combination of the scalar and three-dimensional vector product leads one automatically to the division algebra of octonions. And then, depending on it was noticed first by Michel and myself that dealing with spin 9 as a subgroup of the automorphism group of the exceptional Jordan algebra, algebra of 3x3 matrices of octonion, one comes, one arrives precisely at the gauge group of the standard model, something which was then derived in a direct way using the action of spin 9 on the octonions on O2 by Krasnov, and Leighton had followed a similar procedure, starting with the complexification of the exception of Jordan algebra and its automorphism group E6, and going to the symmetry of one generation, you obtained extension, left-right symmetric extension of the symmetry group of the standard model. Now, our point here, as I announced beforehand, is to use the superselection of the weak hypercharge. What is the motivation for this? People of the older generation, like me, are accustomed to see the hypercharge of as a broken symmetry. Hypercharge, even the name, comes from hyperons, and it was an approximate symmetry. But it evolved in the standard model to not just to an exact symmetry for all processes we know, but it is the central generator of the gauge group of the standard model. So it commutes with all symmetry generators, and by Noether's theorem, with all conserved observables. But also, if we realize the Clifford algebras, Clifford 4, with two fermionic oscillators, pairs of oscillators, creation and annihilation operators, and Clifford 6 by a triple of creation and annihilation operator, denoted here by B, J. So we have A alpha, alpha equal 1 and 2, generators of the Clifford 4, and BJ, J equal 1, 2, 3, generators of Clifford 6. Then we can realize the weak isospin, left isospin generators as familiar combinations of A1 star A2 are J I plus, A2 star, the conjugate is I minus, and their commutator is the third component of the weak isospin, while B, the invariant combination of B, J star, the sum of commutators, 1/3, gives B minus L, the baryon minus lepton number, which is part of the definition of the hypercharge. The hypercharge itself has the most natural definition for an algebra of K creation and annihilation operators. The most natural operator when you have such an algebra is the number operator. And it turns out that 1/2 the hypercharge is nothing but the weighted difference of number operators. 1/3 of the sum of 3 number operators minus 1/2 the sum of the 2 flavor operators. And this hypercharge defines U1 transformation group of the creation and annihilation operators, which has opposite signs and different 1/3 phase factor and 1/2 phase factor for the B and the A's. And superselection of observables means that immediately it reduces the symmetry, the Lie algebra of the symmetry, to operators of the type A alpha star A beta and BJ star BK, which generate the first commutator generates U2 and the second U3. So we have a one parameter extension of the gauge Lie algebra of the standard model, and this extra generator is precisely the B minus L, which we introduced in the very beginning here. So what we gain with it would take time and look artificial to describe the generators of the gauge group of the standard model in terms of the gamma mu commutator with gamma nu, as we usually describe the Lie algebra of associated with the Clifford algebra, which gammas we have to select, while this basis of fermionic oscillator we have easy to remember and natural formulas which give the color symmetry extended by B minus L and the weak isospin. In the only variable which goes depends on both A and B is precisely the hypercharge, the difference of number operators. However, these are the obvious invariants, but there appear some unexpected ones. These are the product of all annihilation operators and the product of all creation, all 5 creation operators. We have here e to the I 5 over 3, d to the I 5 over 2 with the opposite signs. So omega and omega star are also invariants. Well, they are not Hermitian, but their sum or weighted sum with complex conjugate factors are Hermitian, and their products are both Hermitian. And this is the primitive, the prime Jordan subalgebra, which corresponds precisely to the sterile neutrino. So when we will consider particles alone and distinguish particles from antiparticles, we should take aside the algebra of sterile neutrino, because in it we may have, in effect, the physical basis of Majorana neutrinos, which don't distinguish particles from antiparticles. So already this was a kind of unexpected bonus from singling out the hypercharge as a superselection rule. So we can distinguish particles from antiparticles only for y different from zero. And nu r and antiparticles, so the right-handed neutrino, and into antiparticles, which is left-handed, and in neutrino left, are not physically well distinguished. They are not observed experimentally so far. We have only indirect indication from neutrino oscillations that they exist, but we don't have the right to separate them. We may be obliged to work as it is in a popular theory with Majorana neutrino. So, therefore, we'll consider now, we would like to restrict our Clifford algebra to the space of particles. Let me explain. We consider the algebra corresponding to the functions of on internal space, so to speak, algebra characterizing the internal space of particles. Why one chooses Clifford 10? Clifford 10 has a single irreducible representation of dimension 32, and 32 is precisely, it's a real representation, it's precisely the number of both particles, fermions and antifermions, including the sterile neutrino, and has no, and one is not forced to introduce, if one start with popular SO10 good ground unified theory, one then has to use the adjoint representation. One has to use the adjoint representation, which has lepto quarks and predicts unwanted effects like proton decay in so in T for 10, one just has the particles and antiparticles. And after complexification, one has the complex 16-dimensional representations of chiral particles, which is also, as I said in the beginning, something we desire and we are accustomed to have in with usual vial spinners. But then the procedure borrowed from the non-commutative geometry approach consists in taking tensor product of this internal space algebra with the ordinary spinners function or rather quantized fields of space-time belonging to the spinor bundle, to the spinor representation of the Poincaré group. And since we have here both left and right chiral spinors and particles and antiparticles, and we have the same in the space-time part of the tensor product, this creates a problem of fermion doubling. One should actually say quadrupling, which was noted long ago by Gracia Bondier and co-authors. And to reduce the problem, we would, since we anticipate multiplication with four-dimensional spinors, we consider the projection on the particle space. And here plays a role the fact this was done without special treatment of particles and antiparticles by Michel Dubois-Violette and myself a year ago. And we had reduction to the 16-dimensional particle space. And we defined then a superconnection in that space. Here, the novelty is that we'll make a reduction to the 15-dimensional space of particles with non-zero values of hypercharge, which are clearly distinguished from antiparticles. And this will have interesting consequences, as we'll see. This is the main novelty of the paper which I'm talking about now. Well, let me introduce some technicality. We have five pairs of basic projectors in our space. These are the products of in the two opposite orders of creation and annihilation operators. We have A alpha star A alpha and A star, their sum is equal to the unit operator. These are the canonical anti-commutation relations, and same for the B. So we could say that we have five projectors and the unit operators, but it is more practical to speak about five pairs of projectors with five relations, namely pi alpha plus pi alpha prime is 1 for alpha equal 1 and 2, and pj and plus pj prime is equal to 1 for j equal 1, 2, and 3. And I remind you that alpha refers to the flavor, j to the color index. And in terms of this, we can construct the basic projectors on color quarks. They happen to be given by triple of by a product of 3, 1 pj and pk prime, pl prime, where j, k, and l will always be in our formula a permutation of 1, 2, 3, which means they will be different. And now, L, the projector or the fourth color lepton, will have to be P1, P2, P3. However, this will give four leptons, as we have four quarks, four flavors of quarks for each given color. But we would like to throw away the right-handed neutrino. So we subtract from 1 the product of 2 of these projectors, pi 1 and pi 2. In fact, primitive states in this Jordan algebra approach to quantum theory are products of five elementary projector solids. And there are 2 to the 5th such product of primitive projectors. And I have written just as example, the primitive projectors corresponding to the left-handed neutrino and electron, and to the right-handed electron. Oh, here there is an error. This is the right-handed neutrino, what is written pi 1, pi 2, which we throw away. I have to write pi 1 prime and pi 2 prime in this place. Well, Jordan algebras, the particle algebra can be then decomposed into irreducible components, primitive Jordan, prime Jordan subalgebras, which are distinguished by the hypercharge. I think this is once the classification of primitive of prime irreducible component of a Jordan algebra was given by Jordan von Neumann and Wigner in 1934. And if I try to explain it in detail, could take a separate lecture, but they are determined by just two numbers, say a rank and the degree of the algebra, and it has been written down for this particular case in the preprint. So I will not stop on this. I will go to things which have physical significance. I will jump over the interplay between symmetries and observables in the Jordan algebra. There is a paper on understanding of Noether symmetry in terms of Jordan algebras by John Baez. It's an interesting but side story for me now. Now we come to I've noticed that the complex chiral spinors are conveniently considered as complexified pairs of octonions. This is done in two alternative way in a preprint by Brian and in the work in progress of Kirill Krasnov, which we heard talk already. The Higgs field was the motivation for considering non-commutative geometry. There is a description by Maldacena, popular way of describing the gauge theory of the standard model. It's a beauty and the beast. The beauty is the gauge theory, and the beast is the Higgs. And what non-commutative geometry approach and the superconnection approach, which is a variation of it, tries to make the beast also beautiful. So in terms of the Higgs field finds a natural place as the old part of a Z2 graded Clifford algebra. Every Clifford algebra has natural Z2 grading, and the gauge group is always part of the even part, while the Higgs field intertwines left and right and belongs to the odd part of the Clifford algebra. But here we can say something more. It turns out, so we'll defining the particle projection of our field algebra in the natural way. You would take the projector on particle space to be the sum P, capital P, of projection on the leptons and projection on quarks. The quarks is the normal, usual projection, sum of three quarks, three colors, each of four flavors, while the lepton here is projected on lepton as throwing away anti-leptons. Here has new quality. It's a three-dimensional projection on electron neutrino and left-handed electron and electron neutrino and right-handed electron only. Well, it turns out that and that's a crucial point already stressed in our work with Michel, that projecting out, say, so to speak, quark creation and annihilation operators gives zero. And that corresponds to the fact that there is no Higgs which would generate symmetry breaking of color of QCD. This is automatic here when we make the particle projection. One may then ask, don't we lose the SU3 generators, which we do need? No, when you have, it turns out that this doesn't happen. When we have a product of BJ star BK and project on the particle space, we get this product multiplied by a projection by a number operator of B star L BL, where again JKL are a permutation of 1, 2, 3. And so, in fact, L is determined when we know the pair JK. And BJK, defined by capital BJK, defined by this formula, are, well, you see it, satisfy the same permutation relations as the SU3 generators. So the projector saves the observables, which we don't want to lose, but it automatically kills the unwanted components of the Higgs field, which is odd field. Well, the projection of A alpha or A alpha star. When I write the star in parentheses, it means that it's either creation or annihilation operator. That changes. It's not zero. It belongs to the odd part of the lowest dimensional simple Lie superalgebra, the superalgebra SL2/1. Well, the quark projection of the Weber creation and annihilation operators gives just the same creation and annihilation operators multiplied by the quark projection. So, here is an explicit expression of the projection with respect to this three-dimensional lepton space. It turns out that it gives just the odd generators of this simple Clifford superalgebra, which has eight altogether generators, four odd and four even. And the four odd, and I found that there was a paper which that was a site issued, the description of all Lie superalgebra is given by Victor Katz, but here there is an analysis in depth of this particular superalgebra in a paper by Gertz Kuella and Volker Schumerus, and it turns out to allow immediately a simple identification. So this third order operators, still odd. So we see that the projection on particle space makes these odd generators into more general odd elements of the algebra Clifford 4, namely odd elements of third order products of three generators. Here I have reproduced the basic anti-commutation relations for the odd generators. The remaining generators are nothing but the weak isospin and the hypercharge. Now I came to the notion of superconnection. It was first as a model with such a superalgebra with an unusual application was introduced in 1979, the same year as the paper of Castelbuoni and Gatto. For Clifford algebras, independently by Yuval Neyman and Fairley, and then only 6 years later rediscovered and named in mathematics by Quillen and collaborators, and then rather rarely, I wonder why, used once by Cockcroft. Of course, there are more references, but I mention a few which distinguish. Very nice exposition of Röpsdorf, which was known to Michel, and Michel initiated the use of it in our context. Now, the most recent application is therefore our joint work with Michel, and afterwards, a week later or a few weeks later, a couple of papers of Jean-Thierry Meek, which I was inspired for understanding the role of Bianchi identity, which I think my time is approaching to conclusion, so let me go a little faster. The notion of superconnection is a generalization of the ordinary connection. D is D plus A, where A D is differential of X, and A is gauge one form, gauge field one form. And here, since this one forms, the differential one forms under commute, we multiply by the chirality D to commute automatically with Higgs field phi, which belongs to the odd part of the Clifford algebra. You know that in non-commutative geometry, they multiply the internal part of the Dirac operator by gamma 5 in order to anti-commute with the space-time. Here, following Thierry Micke, do the opposite. We multiply by the chirality of internal space. We multiply the usual connection. And when we go to curvature, since chirality commutes with D and has square 1, we'll obtain the usual curvature for the usual ordinary part of the curvature. Now, so then, as I said, once we have the curvature form, we can write the bosonic Lagrangian. Here there is a subtlety, the bosonic Lagrangian, which is just the absolute value square of the curvature, turns out to have only trivial minima with respect to the Higgs field. And but we see that the Bianchi identity, which is equivalent to the super Jacobian identity of the super algebra, admits a more general solution when we add a constant operator to the Higgs field. And here is a point which will play a role. The Higgs field has two parts, one which has the projector on three space leptonic, and another which keeps the all creation operators on each of the color subspaces. They have different normalization, and rho is a factor which equates to makes coherent the two normalizations. I think I'm at the end of my time, so perhaps I will just summarize. I will not let me say, this term in the curvature, the term kai commutator of D with phi is the one which in the bosonic Lagrangian is responsible for the masses of the gauge bosons. And that part of the mass formula, which gives 1-0 mass eigenvalues and the usual relation between W and Z masses with the tangens of the Weinberg-Kangel, is about the same, and the derivation is the same as in grand unified theory. However, what is new is a prediction, as I said in the beginning, of the Higgs mass, and that comes from equating the norm of the force color, so to speak, the leptons, with each of the standard colors. The fact that the leptonic space is smaller, it has three elements, makes for the factor rho, which turns out that to equate the two norms, we need rho square equal 1/2. And it is this relation which gives a similar, which gives it is this rho which gives a relation between the Higgs mass and the W mass. It is the Higgs mass squared is 4 1 plus 6 rho to the fourth over 1 plus 6 rho squared times the W mass square, and this turns out to be just 4 times the theoretical cosine of the Weinberg angle squared times the W mass, and that's verified with amazing accuracy. I was surprised to find it. It was not Satana. So now, in the concluding remark, I repeat what I think is the important thing. Technically, it was important to present Clifford 10 as such a tensor product, Z2 graded, and we saw that projection on particles acted differently on the two factors and made sure that Higgs breaks only the flavor symmetry as it should and gives the color symmetry intact. And if speaking about open problems, there are plenty. The main open problem, in my view, is an understanding of the three generations and CKM matrix, like the ugly part of the standard model. And I think we speak about triality, because there is three in triality and in the number of generation. But so far, triality plays the role in the Yukawa coupling. That is, we have left and right spinors, and the Higgs field, which plays the role of an internal space vector. So it's a coupling of three objects. And I think it's correctly noticed that as we throw away the color part of it, that it is, in fact, quaternionic triality, as it was emphasized in the talk of Meyer in the call. But I mean, the use of triality or of something else which comes with the Octonian formalism to understand the three generation and to reduce the awfully large number of parameters which come with the Yukawa coupling and the CKM matrix. I think this is the real challenge which remains to any theoretical approach aiming to understand, simplify, make more attractive the standard model. Thank you.
Thank you for the
I can start. I have a question. So you have this new relation between Higgs mass and W mass.
Yeah.
Maybe can you show? Oh, it's here. So, at what energy is this relation satisfied to 1% accuracy?
No.
Theoretical. But,
let me say, since I claimed that it is with big accuracy, I should explain that big accuracy is achieved if we look at the experimental numbers, which are at the experimental energy, not in some fantastic, very high unification energy. However, we take, I said, the theoretical cosine squared, the theoretical one is the tangent of the Weinberg angle squared is 3 over 5. Of course, that people believe is only that is not quite fitting the observed Weinberg angle, and the conventional wisdom is that the Weinberg angle, which comes in our theory as well, but it has been derived first in grand unified theories, can only be true in unification scale, and then one has to look what renormalization group flow does with it for observable energies. Here, there is, if you like, something not very clean, that I take this coefficient, which is 4 times the square of the theoretical Weinberg angle, with its theoretical value, 5 over 2. And the relation we have is that the mass of the Higgs is square root of 5 over 2 times the mass of the W. If you don't speak about the Weinberg angle, but say this is the numerical coefficient which you obtain, then this relation is satisfied with the present day experimental value. So it's the energy which are presently observed at LHC.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. but not with the volume of angle at LHC energy.
Yeah. Well, I said what. So, in effect, maybe you're right that that we expect from such three first kind of approximation, three level approximation, to be valid only at some unobserved very high energy unification scale and so on. And the fact that we have a relation which is satisfied at presently observed energy may be viewed as accidental. I mean, I think that one should have a more detailed analysis to really answer this question, whether, but I don't believe that this is purely accidental. I think that this is telling us something, because I didn't choose the numbers to fit. They were naturally coming up.
Could I just add, I think that sounds like not necessarily a problem, in the sense that M Higgs and M weak, I mean, sorry, M Higgs and MW are ultimately both curvatures of the, you know, effective potential at the VEV, and that the effective potential doesn't run with, the full effective potential does not run with scale. So it's consistent with those all being true at the gut scale, I think.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'm not sure there are people waiting to ask more questions, so let me ask another one. The sterile neutrino is one of the most interesting things there is in grand unified theory, because seesaw mechanism usually explained using right-handed neutrino, right? So, I mean, you've done a lot of work projecting right-handed neutrino out.
Yeah.
Can you comment on this? It seems that you're throwing away some very interesting physics by this model. At least, well, the seesaw mechanism is usually based on it. So can you comment on it?
No, I'm rather separating the physics of the particles of the old standard model from the physics of the sterile neutrino. All we know is that the sterile neutrino is sterile. It doesn't interact with, don't see it. It doesn't interact with the ordinary particles. And so I only use the fact that we are not entitled to speak, to distinguish between sterile neutrino and sterile antineutrino. And therefore, when projecting on particle space, I only spoke about, I called particles leptons with y smaller than zero, strictly negative, and quarks with strictly positive y. I threw away the y equals zero subspace. In fact, I didn't mention, but it is in the paper which you have, the fact that I lost my So never mind.
Okay, there is one more question from Sajin there, so please go ahead.
Hello, okay, can you hear me?
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, I have a question about the exceptional job in algebra K3A. So in some of your written papers, you write down the characteristic equations of K3A. As we know, it's a cubic equation. If I were to use the 3x3 Hermitian matrices to remember represent element formula, what might be the significance of the root of the cubic equation?
It was very difficult to understand the question, so maybe you can.
Could I suggest, Ivan, because it's loud on your end, it's hard to hear the question. Could you mute your mic, Ivan, while the question is being asked, and then we could unmute when you're answering?
Mm-hmm. So, should I
repeat?
Okay.
Let me try.
So go ahead, Tejinder.
Okay, can you hear me now? So I have a question about the exceptional Jordan algebra J3A. In some of your recent papers, you write down the characteristic equation for J3A. It is a cubic equation, as we know. Suppose we were to use these 3x3 Hermitian matrices to represent three-generation elementary fermions, what could be the significance of the roots of this cubic equation? Because they are invariants of the algebra. They must mean something. Thank you. No, he's muted, I think. He's muted.
Yes. We haven't gone very far with the exceptional Jordan algebra because the exceptional Jordan algebra, all its modules or its representations are multiples of this algebra. What we know more is the algebra, the subalgebra of one generation, and then we replace the algebra, the corresponding algebra then would be J28 instead of J38. And we don't make any use of the character equation of G28 because we replace the algebra G28 by its associative envelope, one of the type of associative envelope, which is the algebra Clifford 9. And now, afterwards, we were working essentially with Clifford 9. And my present expose was about Clifford 10. So the direct analysis and making conclusions from the characteristic equation of the Jordan algebra itself, I mean, mathematically, of course, the characteristic equation should tell us something, but our experience is of different kind. I cannot say anything directly about it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
thank you.
Carol, I see Cole has a question.
Can you hear me? Okay, perfect. I actually just wanted to, one of the things I wanted to do was clarify that what the answer was to Kirill's question. So Ivan, can you repeat again? You have this hypercharge that you're using to separate your particles into different Jordan subalgebras. And so you've got one of these subalgebras is holding the sterile neutrinos. Can you clarify, you're just separating that space, you're not actually throwing away the sterile neutrinos, is that right?
In fact, what I wanted to say, to answer to Kirill, we are not throwing away neutrino. We consider separately the rest, and I think we have a physical motivation and justification to separate the rest, because the experience tells us that they don't interact. But it is just not the subject of my present paper, which I present here, to go deeper into physics of sterile neutrino. This is a matter of the future, and I'm not sure whether I rather would not venture to think that such general consideration, like belonging to a separate Jordan algebra, would tell us much about it. We have to think about it independently. But I think it is significant that when we decide to separate, not to throw away, but to separate the sterile neutrino sector from what we call particles and antiparticles, just because of this, we obtain the possibility to have a relation, to derive a relation between the Higgs mass and the W. As a matter of fact, if we don't assume this, we also find a relation, but people don't speak about it. It is just that the Higgs mass is twice the W mass, which is very wrong experimentally. It's 160 is considerably bigger than 125. So we improve one relation, which is very far from the mark, by just separating, not throwing away, the sterile neutrinos.
Okay, and so do you anticipate being able to write down both Dirac masses and Majorana masses, mass terms? So I meant mass terms.
If the question is about the fermionic Lagrangian, I've written it down in the paper. I didn't speak here about it. There was no time, but the lack of time was not the only reason I didn't talk about it. I think the fermion part of the Lagrangian really demands the mixing of generation. Physically, we know that, and that external problem, so to speak, we don't know how to do it. But even in the case of one generation, I must say that what this paragraph, this section is writing is provisional. There are real problems in this putting together the Weil spinors and the. In fact, we have to separate. It's not just simple tensor product. It's multiplying Weil spinors with what properly corresponds to this part of the internal space Lagrangian. And I think that is under investigation. And by finished your talks.
Yes.
The same words.
Okay. Can I ask you one more question?
Please.
Okay, so do you have any feeling for why the hypercharge operator is special from an algebraic perspective? Like why hypercharge and not some other U1?
Yeah. First, I think I said, but I will repeat. First,
I do remember. There could be other. So I do remember what you said. You said it was a difference between the number operators. You could also imagine other kind of equally natural generators, for example, the sum of those two terms or the number operator for U5.
I don't like U5. There was also the fact, which is true for the present theory of standard model, that why is the center, the hypercharge is the center of the Lie algebra of the standard model. That is, it is only symmetry among the symmetries of the standard model, which commutes with all other symmetries, with all other generators of the gauge group. It's just the generator of the center, of the U1 center of the gauge group. So if we believe in, it's a kind of thing I take from the theory which I want to justify or to derive, but I take only one feature. I take the fact that the hypercharge is central. In the present formulation of the standard model gauge group, it commutes with all other generators. And also, we cannot even conceive, I don't know a simple way to conceive violation of hypercharge. Even if we have proton decay, for instance, Majorana neutrino, it violates B minus L because it jumps B minus L with 2. But at the same time, the right-handed third component of the isospin jumps with minus the same quantity, and the hypercharge is well defined in zero for the Majorana neutrino as well, while B minus L is not. So in effect, missed to answer Kirill's question at the end, is that the gauge group of the standard model can be defined as the group that annihilates all generators, annihilates a sterile neutrino. That throws away the extra B minus L generator.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any more questions? So maybe we're quite late already, so maybe we should wrap it up. So Ivan, thank you again for a very interesting talk.
Thank you.